not, you can leave. Or you can stay. We're going to have a good time today. Now, okay, I need a show of hands. How many people this is their first time talking about the Enneagram? Okay, I have some handouts here that briefly explain what we've been going over for the last 2 days, because I don't want to spend too much more time talking about centers and the initial type descriptions. I have a handout, I think I've got enough for everybody in the room, that are basically single-line descriptions of the 9 different types or perspectives that we're using in the Enneagram system. I'm going to start them over here. If this lady will stop her quill. It's okay, I know Gabby, she's a friend of mine. Was a friend of mine. You can't please everybody any of the time, you know? It's all right. Okay. Go ahead and take these. And I'll start these over here. If you already have the sheets, please don't take a second one because I'm running out. This matrix or this chart that I have here basically goes through the 9 different types and then the terms that I'm using to describe the types throughout the workshop. Okay, so you have the inspector and the assistant. These are new terms, don't worry, we'll get to it. But as you go across, there'll be the self-identity. What we're going to talk about today is threat and defense. What happens when a person's personality gets threatened? When you feel like your self-identity is under attack, there's usually a natural defensive mechanism that you're going to use to try and push whatever's attacking you back aside. We're going to talk about that today. So all of that is on this sheet, and we're going to go through as much as we can. And I'm going to start those back here with Tom. Just take one and pass it around. Okay, and these are good. Again, if you weren't here yesterday, make sure you have a handout you can be reviewing as we move through. I will briefly review in 5 minutes or less.
Do you have 2.5?
They're going around.
Yeah, they're coming.
They're coming. That should tell you something. Well, for me, anyway, it works. Okay. Some of you have been here before, some of you haven't. My name is Fred McCandless, and we're going to start getting into the nitty-gritty of what is called the Enneagram. The Enneagram, broken down, is two Greek words shoved together that mean, Ennea means 9, gram means point. I'm going to show you a 9-pointed figure. Don't worry about the lines right now. That comes after what we talk about today. The lines indicate basically like a road map. These are directions of movement. What we're going to be talking about is very specific to each particular point on the Enneagram. The idea behind the system is that you have 3 centers, a gut, a heart, and a head center. I've been showing clips from The Wizard of Oz here for the last couple of days to exemplify the different types. The scarecrow represents the head center, the tin man represents the heart center, and the lion represents the gut center. When these 3 centers, which are in us all the time, acting interdynamically, when they act appropriately, we have balance and our self-esteem tends to go up, and we tend to not use the defense mechanisms that we use so automatically every day. By defense mechanism, I mean something that comes up as fast as your hand comes up to block a softball before it hits you in the face. Or sometimes as fast as your hand goes up to salute somebody who's cut you off in traffic. This is a defense mechanism, and they're usually, and I'll point this out, they are usually rehearsed to the point where they become automatic. We learn these when we're very young, because as children, our self-identities are forming. And so we develop this persona, which is the Greek word for mask, which we use to wrap around ourself so we can be safe. The purpose of the centers is mostly to keep us safe. If you run out, let me know. I'll make more, and you can come back tomorrow again. Okay, basically we're talking about motivation. Human beings are motivated away from pain, for the most part, except for certain individuals, and I don't think there's any here, and toward pleasure. When we're feeling okay, when we're feeling like things are going our way, we tend to experience a feeling of satisfaction, contentment, and that makes us feel good. But feeling good is different for different types of people. What makes one type feel good may totally nauseate another type, and vice versa. Pain is usually a universal denominator. We all pretty much don't like it. If I stub my toe, I pull my leg back. These automatic knee-jerk responses that we have with our personalities, they happen so fast, most of us are not aware of them. The first thing to do to become more aware of what's going on is to learn what your automatic responses are, so you can be watching for them. If, for example, I have a tendency when somebody approaches me to pull back from them and sort of take them in and see if they're a threat or not, that is an automatic response that I usually don't have any control over because I'm not aware that it's happening. As you begin to put your key into the different Enneagram doors, eventually one of them will turn and open. But your key is only going to fit one door. Now, during the last few days, I've had discussions with many of you about how you see yourself in all the types, and you're not quite sure, oh my God, there's 9 different things, and you've talked so much, what do I do? Well, the point is that all of the different types are in you all of the time. But there is one particular type that you're going to favor over all the others. And this will be the one that you use most often. And because of that, it's probably one of the ones that you're least aware of. So what I'm asking you to do is, as I talk, and I talk a lot, consider where you tend to spend most of your time. Each one of these types is like a city, and one of them is going to be your hometown. I call these titles the gift. And we've gone around and talked about the different qualities inside each of these particular types. The sheet that I handed around goes through very basically and tells you what the different types have as a basic orientation. I call this the gift. It tends to be the positive qualities inside each of the 9 types. In just a bit of review, remember the 9 types represent mixtures of the 3 different centers. If I lay this like this, okay, it's kind of confusing. There's a lot of geometry here. But you can see the circles inscribed inside the larger circle. The larger circle represents you. Okay. Ideally, you would have the positive characteristics of all 9 types operating in concert with each other, like a well-tuned piano or a well-tuned orchestra. What usually happens, though, is that one instrument, one note, is a little out of tune. I'm asking you to kind of look hard, listen to your lives, and find out which part of you is out of tune. Which part of you do you overuse? Right. We have the inspector. These are the number ones, and I will be referring to numbers and names, so this is important. The inspector ones are noticed as perfectionists. That's what they like to do. They like to impose order on the world. They get it in their minds that things should be a certain way, and then they try to make things that way. And it's unfortunate if you get in their way, because they will tell you how to work so that this is accomplished. What's important to them is the ideal that they've created, and they're very hardworking. That's how they define themselves. I am hardworking. If that self-identity gets threatened, then they have a response. That they're not hardworking enough, that it's not good enough. They try working even harder, even harder. Something has to drive that kind of response. And we're going to talk about that. The assistant, too, defines themselves as I am helpful. This is me. I like to help people. I like to help you understand. I like to help you get your coffee. I like to help you do whatever you have to do, because by helping you, I am better defined. I have defined myself in terms of helping you. You'll notice the mixture here. The inspector one is a gut-oriented person, which means they are moving forward. They can be in your face a lot. What they do is they do, then they feel. So they tend to become very attached emotionally to what they're doing. That gives them this sense of courage, this sense of idealization that moves them forward, because they feel like they own the ideal. It becomes a piece of them. The assistant, too, on the other hand, feels first and then does. So they're very attuned to your needs. And as soon as they feel that you need something, their tendency is to just go and do it for you, whether or not you ask them. Okay, that can be a downfall, because they're not thinking as much as they're feeling and doing. The administrator three is a very goal-oriented person. They identify with what they do. Their identity is, I am successful. I will do things that make me feel successful, but I want to be successful to you. It's a relational type. In order to be successful, I have to do the things that you're going to think are successful. So I will drive the BMW. If by driving that, you see me and say, my God, you're a huge success, aren't you? Because what they're afraid of is failing. They identify so much with what they're doing that if it fails, they think they're failures. It's a difficulty in being able to objectify what they're doing so that they can say, well, the project failed, rather than saying, I'm a failure. Threes are very good at setting goals and working with people and being team leaders, because they really believe that the best way to get things done is to do things with more than one person. They're very good at convincing you and persuading you that what they want is the best thing for everyone. But their goal, remember, is to be successful. So if by encouraging your help, they can succeed, then that's what they'll do. They can be seen as manipulative, but that's not their intent. Okay, but remember, we're talking about motivation on an internal basis, not about behavior. Two different types will have the same behavior sometimes, very different reasons for having it. Both the one and the three, for example, want to succeed. The one wants to realize that ideal that they've created, that things should be a certain way. And they're very hardworking, and they expect you to be hardworking as well. And if you're not, they'll remind you of it. I don't know if you know anybody like this. The three, on the other hand, doesn't really care if you come in a little later and go home a little earlier, as long as the work is done. If you have a piece of a project and they're depending on it, if you can do it in an hour, that's great. But if you need to stay there all night to do it, that's great too. As long as what you're doing gets done. The one, on the other hand, says, well, you should be here 8 hours a day, but if you really want to impress me, be here for 12. The author four defines themselves as being unique or non-ordinary. The worst thing in the world is to be ordinary. My God, I don't want to be ordinary. So the threat is when somebody says, oh, don't worry about it, you're just like everybody else. Panic attack. I don't want to be like everybody else. I want to be special. And they respond with their own defense mechanism. Right, I'll give you some concrete examples of these different types of people in a minute. So number five, a sage, is pretty much as it describes it. Knowledgeable. I want to know things. They're like a miner up in a mine, constantly looking for that new vein of gold, that new knowledge. I want to know more. And like a prospector, they tend to work pretty much by themselves. Now, that doesn't say that all fives are very intelligent. Let's not confuse intelligence with knowledge, because they can become very specialized in what they want to know. They can be an incredible genius as far as chemical engineering goes, but they may have to cook frozen TV dinners. That specialized knowledge is very difficult to get back out of them, because once they have it, they feel they own it. It becomes valuable to them. Primarily head-centered people, knowledge, analytical, knowing things is important. Secondary heart, so they start to feel like they own. They feel important because they own the knowledge. Very difficult for them to integrate the gut center, which tends to be the least used, and express the information. For a five to, or a sage to sit down and actually write a book about what they know is a very difficult process, because it involves doing. They'd much rather go to the library and do some more research. They define themselves as, I am knowing. That's what I am, that's what I do. So if they're asked a question and they don't know, it scares them. That's why, and I've used this example before, at the end of a lecture perhaps, the five might, who's usually behind a table, by the way, they tend to keep something between them and the audience just in case, you know, havoc breaks out and things start getting thrown. They say something like, there aren't any questions, are there? And inside they're saying, please don't anybody ask me anything no more, because I've told you everything that I know about this subject. At least that's what they want you to believe. Fives know a lot. They will probably forget more than you'll ever want to learn from them. Moving around to this facilitator six, these people are like a spider in the middle of a web. Everything in the environment that affects the group, okay, this isn't like a two who's very much interested in what's going on between you and them as individuals. They're very individual need. How can I help you? The facilitator wants to know, how can I help everyone? How can I help the group that I belong to? And their self-identity is, I am loyal. I want to do the best thing for the group, and I expect everybody else to do that too. So they look a little nervous, because sometimes they seem to have too much on their minds. Because unlike fives, you compartmentalize information and put it in little slots, like one of those giant library card racks where they put a little bit here, and a little bit here, and a little bit here. Sixes like to juggle. They keep everything up in the air in front of them all the time. So if any one thing should change, then they can handle it. Okay, this is starting to change, so I need to do something with it, and they'll concentrate. Until somebody throws them something they're not expecting, they're juggling balls, and somebody throws a shoe in, they don't know what to do, and the whole thing can come crashing down. So as they get more and more in the air, they tend to become more and more alert, because they're looking for that shoe. They're expecting it. Moving around to the optimist seven, these are the people who are very optimistic. They define themselves as being joyful and delightful. They're very good at entertaining and storytelling. But as they tell stories, they don't give you much information about themselves. It's like they'll relate a whole incident, and when you're done, you think, God, I really enjoyed that, but what was that all about? They think very quickly, like a pinball machine. They launch an idea in, and goes through all the lights and the clanging and the clattering, and then the ball drops down. It's very fascinating to watch what's going on, but when they're done, you're not really sure what's happened. The optimist seven is good at getting things started. Has a hard time getting them finished, because as soon as something is started, it may spin off another idea, which suddenly becomes more interesting than what they were working on to begin with. So it's not unusual to see five or six books around an optimist's house with bookmarks halfway through, piles of projects that haven't been completed, because what's important to them is what they're working on right now. Acknowledgement? They're not the only type with piles of paper. But they tend to accumulate more than the other types, because remember, they're primarily head, which means they're doing a lot of thinking all the time. New ideas, new possibilities, planning. I'd rather plan the trip than take the trip, because planning it, nothing can go wrong. But taking the trip, oh no, I forgot to put water in the radiator. So it's primarily head with the gut. So it's think, do, and then I'll feel about it later. And sometimes you may get the feeling from them that they don't care about it, that they're more interested in what they want, more interested in doing something fun and entertaining, and say, listening to you talk about your problems. And they look like they're getting real nervous, like they keep looking out the window, or they're not paying attention. What happens, though, is that the optimist seven is most afraid of defining themselves as being joyful. They're most afraid of experiencing pain. That doesn't mean they're afraid of bee stings, although they are, a little bit. They might be fascinated by the bee on their leg and then get stung and not know it until later. But what scares them the most is psychological pain. Because deep down, underneath all of this thinking and doing, they're very, very sensitive. And they block the pain. They take it and they change it into something else. So if you mention a tragedy, they may remember a joke about it. And they'll tell the joke, trying to change the subject. And they tend to be very good at it. They're almost like chameleons. They can slip in and out of their emotions. Because the painful emotions, they don't want to experience. Champion 8 tends to be the type that's in your face all the time. They'll interrupt conversations because what they want is important to them. Remember, it's a do. It's do here, then think about it, and then I'll worry about how you're feeling about it. The eights have been known to be the most abrasive types in the Enneagram. And yet at the same time, they have this marshmallow core where they feel very vulnerable and they want to share that. But they define themselves as being powerful. And that means internally powerful. They want you to know who's got the power in the room. And when they walk into a room, they instinctively look around to see who has the power. Who's got the power in the room? It may not be the person presenting. It may be the person in the corner. But The champion eights tend to know where power is because they define themselves by confronting the world, butt up against it. These types of people tend to be daredevils. Physically, they like to go out and push their bodies to the limit sometimes. Now, this doesn't say for their whole life, but early on, some of your more aggressive people tend to look like gut people because, like, God, this person's bungee jumping? Nude? In the snow? They push the limit. It's like they have this constant pressure on. And the funny thing is about the champion is they live in a very small space. What their concern is everything within about a 4-foot square around them. So they look like they're unfeeling. They don't care. Aren't you thinking about the consequences? Well, not really. The champion doesn't worry about consequences because they think they're invulnerable. They want you to think they're invulnerable. And so by expressing vulnerability, there's a sign of weakness. And that's what they're afraid of. Weakness in themselves, mostly, but weakness in the people around them. Finally, we go to Negotiator 9. These people are the peacemakers. It's okay. It's okay, don't worry about it. Everything will be okay, okay? Okay. The word okay is one of their identity words. I am peaceful. I am okay. I don't care what's happening out there as long as it's okay. I'll be fine. They are the turtle wandering down the road. I'm okay, I'm okay. And suddenly the car comes by, all the legs and arms go in. The shell spins around, head pokes out. I'm okay. Okay. That's what they like to do because they fear conflict. These are very peaceful people. They tend to draw people around them. They're almost a center for people to say, this is a safe person. I like this person. I don't know why intellectually, but I feel pretty safe around this person. I feel accepted. Now, you don't know if they're paying attention to you necessarily, but they tend to be like a nice warm fire in the middle of the room. There's a lot of power. Okay. In nine, there tends to be a lot of personal power. They're gut-centered people, remember. Their primary objective is to stay safe. Survival is the key issue. So if there's a conflict, they will react to the conflict. And I'll tell you how. Okay, here's the different words that I just talked about. If you just want to reflect real quickly. This is how the types talk to themselves. The one says, I'm hardworking. You better be too. Who says, I am helpful. What can I do for you? What can I do for you that's going to make me feel like I'm helping myself? Three says, I am successful. Let's get this done. Help make me successful. Relationally, right? They're wanting you now. The four says, I'm unique. I'm special. Admire me. I'm special. Oh, thank you so much. They like to think they're on a pedestal. The five says, I am knowledgeable. I am knowing. The six says, I am loyal. Aren't we all wonderful? Aren't we all glad to hear you? What do you think? Sixes will ask you, what do you think? Do you think we're having a good time? What do you think? Are we having a good time? Are we doing okay? Sixes check in a lot because they want to know how the group is doing. And if they assume that everything's fine and everything's not, then they're not part of the group. If I'm going to buy a new car and I'm a six, I might ask all my friends, what kind of car do you think I should buy? What do you know about a Ford? Oh, you don't like Fords? Chevy's okay? So they're not really sure what they want because they're not used to getting their power from inside. The seven says, I am joyful. I'm here. Let me entertain you. Let me take you away from your troubles. Let me whisk you away to Never Never Land, where everything's fine. The eight says, I am powerful. Deal with me. I am here to see you, and you can't see the board. Well, I'll give this to you in a minute. And the nine says, I'm okay. I'm okay, you're okay. I'm feeling where that came from. Okay, does everybody have the handouts? Did we run out anywhere?
No, I don't have to.
What did you get?
This one here that she's got.
This one here that she's got there doesn't tell me. The one line descriptions. Where did those run out?
We ran out of
those.
Yeah.
There's a lot more people than I have handouts. Tell you what, if you're done with your handouts, I'm going to take a little pause here. If you're done referring to it for the time being, could I take those one-line description of the types and send them around the room this way? If anybody over here can share, I'll make more and I'll bring them back and pick them up later. But I want everybody to be able to know what we're talking about now, because it's going to get interesting. Thanks. Doesn't have one over there. Oh, I don't know. Next Christmas. Thank you. No. Just if you have somebody with next to you, can look at one. As long as there is a chance to look at it.
Oh, we have one.
All right. Okay.
What about the people of the
Oh, and the sheep seats. How many do we need? There's some coming up right now.
Is there anything else down there?
Oh, I have. Were you here the last couple of days? How many people right now are feeling fairly comfortable about where they are? Oh, good. Send those around. Maybe one for every two people, so we can do it. Okay, because if you think you're comfortable about where you are, and you're pretty confident, this next section is probably going to make you uncomfortable. What? Oh. All of those that think you're sevens? Hold on to your chair so you don't try to leave the room. Okay?
Do you ever combine numbers?
No. But I'll tell you about it.
Except for when you get into the higher numbers, then you know, right?
Oh, you'll see in a second.
Yeah, good.
Most of you, this is what I call the crucible of the system. This is where we're going to talk about threat to self-identity and the response. For most people, this is where they say, oh my God, there I am. Not all people feel it at this point, but upon reflection, you start to realize that you're more in one area than another area.
What are most people?
Do you ever change from one place to another?
Okay, that's a good question and I'll answer it. Different people, okay, in different types, you always remain in your type because it's a motivational type for you. But you can take on characteristics of different types. Right? It's important. For example, if you're an optimist 7 and you have all of this wonderful energy, it's important to develop the creative side of your personality, which would fall toward the 4, toward the emotional side, connecting with people. You don't become a different type. You just develop positive characteristics. Okay? You come around in a spiral. It's a matter of growing, and there is that's what the lines represent, is the different ways that the types connect to other types. Okay? I'm always going to be from California. I can't change that. I was born there. And that's because I grew up there. Whenever I come to Washington, I live in Seattle for the last 17 years, but I still compare my experiences here to what I knew growing up. Everything that I experience in that genuine first self. So if you're from New York and you come to Holden Village, it's going to be very different than somebody from Los Angeles coming to Holden Village, or somebody from Wenatchee coming to Holden Village. Yeah, Tom.
At this point, I think there's a natural defense that builds up in some folks that says, you won't put me in a box. And that's healthy, but nobody's about to put you in a box. Nobody's going to put you anywhere. You will, if you open up, discover that you're from Buffalo or wherever. That doesn't mean you can't travel the world, but it's helpful to know that you came from Buffalo.
And it really, even if you travel the world, it always feels good to come home. Now, one thing that happens with the Enneagram, people have confronted me with this in workshops, is that people will try to type them. Oh, I know, you're a 2, don't worry about it. Or I know, you're a 5, so you shouldn't even think about it. And that can be very confusing. Because then people start going, well, maybe I'm a 5, and they start trying to analyze themselves from a different perspective. The important thing is for you to decide where you are. Only you know where your home is. Somebody may have assumed you've lived in Seattle all of your life. And they may assume, oh, you're a Seattleite. Well, no, I spent the first 12 years of my life someplace else. I feel home when I go there. When I go down to California, I feel a different kind of feeling, a more home feeling, even though I've built my home in Seattle. My origin is someplace else. And with the Enneagram, it's your origin type that you're searching for. So some of you may have to go back into your past and wonder, when did I start taking on a second skin? You're looking for your original personality. What did you first start doing? Because sometimes you can have a different style at work. Maybe you're more of an administrator at work, a goal-oriented, I'm going to get things done kind of person. But when you go home, you don't want to be bothered. You want to go into a little room and hide, and you let your most favorite room might be your den with all your books around you. So maybe you've put on the skin of a three because of your job. Maybe you've made a decision to do the kind of work that requires you to do that. But maybe you're not the happiest person you've ever been. Maybe you'd be happier running circulation in a library. But somehow your goals and your personality conflicted. So you've had to develop another style. And remember, you're going to work at characteristics from that other style that don't belong to your home style. There's something about even the word home style. We like home style cooking. Home style fried chicken. Colonel Sanders made millions of dollars. Okay, this idea of being at home is central to every human being. We all feel part of a family. We all try to remember our childhoods as being good times. Even if there were bad moments, being a child and having that warmth, and children, the idea of the child is really a gut-centered thing. We feel it deep down. It goes underneath our thinking and behind our emotions. We like to feel, we like to have that inner sense of who we are. And sometimes we've traded a lot away to appear to be different, to meet somebody else's needs. And this is one of the most frightening things we can do as people, is to not be true to who we are. So the first step to maybe unlocking some of this debris, some of this false camouflage, is to start being aware of why we do what we do. Am I doing this because it helps me feel better? Or am I doing this because it's what you expect me to do? You ready?
Okay.
Hang on to your chairs. Seat belts fastened? Okay. These are the threat and defense mechanisms belonging to the types. Now, most of this is internalized. You can come sit right here if you want. Okay. There's some chairs scattered back and through that might be a little easier to see the screen. Okay, I'll just let you look at this for a second. The threat is in the large block letters. This is the threat to self-identity. Now on those matrix sheets that I've handed out, you can see what the self-identity is. So it might be a little easier to look at this and look at your sheet. It's the same information. I'm going to start with the head center. Okay. The threat to the Sage 5 is emptiness. By emptiness, that is a hole in what they know. By finding out more about the world, by reading management books, by reading parenting books, by reading, by accumulating information, the five hopes they're not going to run into a situation where they don't know. Because not knowing scares them. Threatens their self-identity. How can I be knowing if I don't know? Creates conflict. So they withdraw. They pull away into the corner, and they try to learn what they don't know. And as they start to learn, then they start to come out. Because now they're knowing again, so it's okay. Now this can be dreadful when a five is having an argument with somebody they love. When the sage runs into a situation and the spouse or the significant other is experiencing an emotion and the five goes, I don't know what I'm feeling. I don't know how to respond to this. I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. That phrase, I don't know, can be very frightening. And as soon as they say, I don't know, then the self-identity says, what? I am knowing. You don't know. Retreat! Run away! And they do. Sometimes they never even leave the chair. They just pull back in their heads. And fives are known for doing things like putting their hands together like this, called steepling, and looking over the top at you while you talk and going, interesting. A personality example of this might even be if you're familiar with Mr. Spock from Star Trek. When faced with the unknown, what does he do? Wants to understand what it is. It may be very dangerous. Fives aren't necessarily afraid of physical discomfort. It's the lack of knowing that scares them more. Because it's a threat to what they are. If they don't know, it frustrates them. So they sit down right where they are and try to figure out what it is. Or they go to their resource, and fives know where their resources are. But the threat is the emptiness. It's that hollowness inside of them. And in Christianity, that hollowness can be where that still small voice speaks to them. Sometimes it's a fear of hearing the truth. Because truth and knowledge aren't always the same thing. So fives tend to build an immense structure of information, and that's where they put their belief in things that are provable, empirical. Something they can experience, something that somebody else has experienced, history, even mathematics, even things that are not real, okay, but they like things that are real, like things to make it real. Well, I don't know why the rock falls like that, but I can draw a mathematical expression that explains it. They're very good at explaining. Think of Yoda in Star Wars, or Obi-Wan Kenobi, or Johnny Carson. These people all seem to have the five personality. Now, I use movie characters because they tend to really emphasize the traits. Real people are harder. I don't know that Johnny Carson's a five, but from the way he sets the desk in front of him when he was on The Tonight Show, and the way that he introduces his guests, he asks questions, and fives will sometimes answer questions with questions when they don't know. If you ask a five, how are you feeling? They'll say, what do you mean, how am I feeling? Or what kind of question is that?
Or what do you think?
Or why should I tell you what I'm feeling? There's this sense that they don't know what they're feeling. There's an unknown. Whoop, you found the hole. So they protect themselves, and it can be outwardly with the questions. These are the kinds of things to be aware of in yourself. Do you do this? Is this one of your defenses? Moving over to the six, they define themselves as being loyal to the group. So what sixes don't like is deviance. If the group is doing something and the six doesn't think it's right, the six has a problem because they have to deviate from the group. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, perhaps, during the Second World War in Nazi Germany, the Nazi movement was sort of a six movement. There was power in the group. There was power in the terror that was spread because of this group. And that there were people who didn't really believe in what they were doing. They hated it. But how do you fight it? There's this fear of appearing deviant. Because if you're deviant, you could be in really big trouble. You could get shot. It was a terrible time. It's not over. There's still a lot of this going on around the world right now. Terror from the group. And the individual that tries to oppose the terror gets run over like a steamroller. So what the sixes will do is project. Now, projection is a psychological term that says, I will take my inner conflict and I will shoot it onto the nearest moving target, and that will be my problem. Example in point, a group of people waiting for the light downtown decide, I'm not going to wait anymore, we're going to cross the street against the light. Now, in Seattle, that's a $47 ticket. So these nine people, dressed as they are, start going across the street. However, the six is at the end of the group. And as the six gets up on the curb, you feel a tap on the shoulder, and guess who it is? It's the policeman. He says, I'm giving you a ticket for jaywalking. Six, who's afraid of being deviant, takes the group and projects, well, everybody else is doing it. Now, as an individual, they're breaking the law, so is everyone else in the group. However, the six says, well, don't just do it to me, give it to everyone. I'm going to project my guilt onto the rest of this group. Okay, Luke Skywalker wants to join the Rebel Alliance, and I believe the guy is a six in the movie. He wants to be part of a big group doing something very important. He doesn't believe in himself. He doesn't believe the force is in him. He spends most of the first movie trying to figure this out. And Yoda, in the second movie, says, listen, it's true.
You had it.
There is no try. There's only do or do not. And Luke doesn't believe in himself. He doesn't believe he can do it. And that's the quandary for most people who find themselves in that sixth projection, or that sixth perspective, excuse me. They don't know how to step out of the group that they're in to be themselves, because by being themselves, they may contradict what the group is trying to do. There may be a gang of youths who are causing, wreaking havoc in a neighborhood, and there's a young man or a young woman in the group who has the sixth personality, feels inside, this is wrong, we shouldn't be painting on this wall. And yet they're more afraid of deviating from that group. And they get up front and lead the group. They're the ones that jump to the fore. Now in the Enneagram, some of the material you may read, you'll hear about counterphobic sixes. And I don't know if I agree with a lot of the counterphobic theory being posed, but what it basically says is a phobia is an uncontrolled fear. A perceived threat, real or not, but it's perceived, so it's real to the individual. A counterphobic six, actually, instead of being more afraid, seems to jump in front and deal with that fear head on. They actually almost deny that the fear is there and then go for the jugular of whatever's bothering them. Now, because they're projecting, they may attack you, and you're not their target, okay? But they see their target on your shoulders. Or they see it in the administration, or they see it in the government, or they see it in the face of politics, or they see it in their family. Whatever the six is dealing with, that projection is hard to deal with until they own it and realize, my God, I'm doing this. The number seven, again, is afraid of psychological pain. It usually comes when they have to deal with difficult feelings, feelings of remorse or regret, loss. Feelings, especially if they've lost somebody important to them through death, maybe lost their job, maybe lost their apartment because they forgot to pay the rent. So the pain that they would be feeling, the crying they might do, is sublimated, which means it is basically changed into something more acceptable. The friend who calls and says, I don't know what to do, my father just died. And the seven says, oh, really? Well, you never liked him anyway. How unfeeling. But to the seven, it's a natural, spontaneous mental reaction to, I've got to protect myself because my father just died 2 years ago and I don't want to think about it. In the movie Sound of Music with Maria von Trapp, played by Julie Andrews, there's a couple of scenes where you see this seven come out. You know, there's the scene where she decides to make clothing out of drapes for the children, which really surprises the number one captain. I think he's a one because he wears a tie to bed. He's always standing like this. And if he got any tighter, he'd just probably disappear. But there's a point where, what's the scene in the movie? Do you remember what happens to her when she panics? Where's the scene? Do you remember anybody? Yeah, why does she run back to the convent? Good, Mark. Anybody? Anybody remember the movie? Oh, good,
Daddy. It's afraid of her own feelings.
She's in love because the woman told her. Was that other, the woman?
The Countess?
That she was in love with the captain, and she said,
the Countess tells Maria that the captain is in love with her. The captain is in love with Maria. And Maria says, oh, no, it couldn't be, because her feelings or that she really loves him and she loves the children. So rather than stay there and deal with the Countess, and the Countess and her little, I don't know, she looks like a three, but I don't know her well enough.
Oh, I think
she's
a three.
She's like, listen, honey, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to marry this rich captain because he has all this money, and I'm rich too, but this is a real good deal. And I know your buttons, and I'm going to push them, and you're out of here. And Maria goes, oh, dear. Back to the convent, where she then goes into seclusion. The seven, their escape mechanism is, I'm going to escape! Now I can go to a movie theater and hide and be totally anonymous.
Or I can get drunk.
Or I can get drunk, or I can get high. I can eat
can do anything I have to do by sublimating the pain into something better, something more enjoyable. But guess what? Pain doesn't go away. And so it sits there. And if you've been on Garbology, it starts to get really ugly. It festers. It's like 2 days after Garbology. It's like, oh my. And then you gotta deal, then it's even worse to deal with. So what do you do to get away from it? You get more drunk. You take more drugs. You rent more videos. You eat more pizza. You go out and have several relationships. You do what you have to do to keep feeling good because this giant hairball is just getting bigger. And pretty soon you can't cough it up. Yes, I have a cat. But I don't have time to tell you about it. Maybe tomorrow I'll come back. Tell you how certain types deal with animals. Moving on to the H. Remember, the eight's self-definition is I am powerful. Right? Eights don't intimidate on purpose, but they know they can. They don't have to worry about how to manipulate you, because just their presence is enough to frighten most people, unless it's another eight. And that's a real interesting show. Yeah, it's like, my dad can beat up your dad. Well, yeah, my dad can beat up your dad. You see this little, and then the dads go, oh, man, we're both fives. We're good. Or my mom can get your mom, and then they pour each other a cup of tea. But that's a stereotype. Now throw that out the window. Because in our culture, a lot of men are expected to be eights. Expected to be champions. Expected to go out, no matter what, take care of their families, and I'm going to take care of this, and I'm in charge. That's the expectation, that they grow up to be strong warrior types. And the women, who may actually be warriors, are expected to fulfill the role of the assistant, to put everyone else's needs ahead of their own. Guess what? It's not true. It's a big lie we've been lied to. The eight looks at weakness in themselves, the feeling that, what if I can't deal with this? What if, you know, they're on their way down off the bridge and the bungee cord stretches a little too far? There's this sudden sense of, oh my God, I could die here. But what does the eight do?
Nah, it won't break.
Their hair touches the rock. Oh, it's not gonna break. See, I told you. And then they wake up in the hospital with a halo on their head. Not a light halo, I mean a metal halo. The denial process in the eight seems to fortify their strength, but what it really does is it makes them appear weaker. Okay. As in the seven's process of sublimating the pain actually gets worse. In the six's problem, where their deviance actually lends them to do more projecting, when the eight feels weakness, they deny it, and in denying it, they become weaker. But the eight isn't aware of it. The denial thing is, I'm going to come up against you. And you say you're stronger than me, and I'm going to say no. So I start pushing on you. I'm going to deny that you're stronger. And no matter how much it starts to hurt, I'm going to keep denying it. It's like that silly old ram that thought he'd bought a hole in the dam, and he did it. Well, the dam still collapsed. Might have killed him. Eights don't know when to quit. The funny thing about them is that when they get really stressed, when they really feel like they can't do it and you're fighting them, then they step out of the way and watch you fall on your face. And they laugh at you. But what's happened is they have denied that you're stronger, and then suddenly they let you go and they say, well, I guess you are. But they pull their power out. This can be somebody in a corporate situation who has a lot of power in the company, and is really, a lot of people are depending on them, and they leave. Because they realize that they're not as strong. A strong eight realizes that it's not important to be powerful all the time. That real power comes with giving power away, empowering other people. It's the biggest challenge, because they're so used to having it, because they feel like they've got to protect themselves against the world. Gut center. Gotta be here, gotta deal with this. It's very difficult to say,
Kathy, I'm going to give this to you and I want you to do what you can with it. I give you full authority. I don't even want a little bit. They like to keep a string. Final say.
Maybe. Well, let me know and I'll make the final decision.
Real power comes with giving it away, but the eight and their threat is very reluctant to do that. They deny that you have enough personal power to do it. The nine, this is interesting. You confront the nine with a problem. Their threat is conflict of any kind. And the nine will say, what problem? What conflict? There's no problem here. The house is burning down. They're saying, what are you talking about? It's an anesthetization. They deaden the pieces of themselves that experience the conflict. The conflict doesn't go away. They pretend it goes away. They anesthetize. You'll have an argument sometimes with a nine, and a week later you'll say, you remember that argument we had? And they literally will say, I don't know what you're talking about, because they don't remember. It can be called selective amnesia. They really, and really physically, they maybe they do remember, but consciously they don't. They don't want to remember, because it makes them uneasy. Nines have a very difficult time projecting themselves into the world, even though they're all God energy, and all they have to do is step forward and say, well, this is what we're going to do. And most people will say, okay. They don't think they have the strength. So that they're caught in this feeling of, it's not okay, it's not okay. So I'll make it okay, I'll pretend it's okay. I'll layer it over, I'll put something on top of it so it's okay. I'll build, so the pipes are rusting. Well, I'll get water from the neighbors. And then they get used to doing it and they forget that their own pipes are falling apart. The number one, threat is anger. It's their own anger that they don't like. They're afraid of it because the ones tend to be the perfectionists of the Enneagram. Things should be a certain way. And I think most ones were in a fraternity or a sorority in college called shoulda, coulda, woulda. Where things should be better, they would be better, they could be better if only you would, only I would, if only. Well, when things aren't as they should be, when this crazy, mixed up, complex world that we have intrudes upon their order, when the crabgrass comes up in the perfectly manicured lawn, the one responds to their initial feeling of anger with idealization. I shouldn't be angry. I shouldn't feel this. So they have the anger, but they're not sure how to feel it. So it can come out very inappropriately. Instead of pulling the crabgrass out of the lawn, they go down to the rental place, they rent a rototiller, and they do the whole lawn over again. The anger has been channeled into something else. But it's the idealization that there can't be imperfection. And if they get angry, they're not perfect. So therefore, I can't get angry. And it's a locked logic loop. They don't know how to get out of it. And it bothers the people that they tend to be around because the ones hold it inside. They don't know how to let go of it without scaring people. And I liken it to high-octane jet fuel. They have these ideals they need to reach, so they need that energy to be able to push them in that direction. But at the same time, they risk burning the people around them. And ones really care about the people they love. The problem comes with when they feel anger and they express it, and it's dangerous. They feel like, I want to be able to express my anger. But when it's expressed, it comes out maybe inappropriately, critically. You have a comment over there?
Oh, I have a child that's a one. My father was a one. My child, and he's been angry since little boy. You know, but he's a perfectionist. Can get to there sometimes.
Now, well, these are the people that don't like bees. You have to get an A, or you got to do it over.